Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle and the Insider's insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, as the standoff continues between Ecuador and the British government over the Julian Assange extradition, we'll explore the politics of WikiLeaks and Latin America. Then on the Scholar Circle, Mitt Romney's financial advantage over President Obama has more than doubled in July. How much will that financial advantage matter in the final election results? British officials continue to assert that they have legal obligations to send WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange to Sweden for questioning and accusations of sexual assault and rape. But Ecuadorian officials, including President Rafael Correa, have declared that the standoff with Assange and the Ecuadorian embassy could go on for years. Assange claims he is open to questioning, but is attempting to avoid extradition to the U.S., where he believes he is under threat of prosecution for the so-called cable gates. The situation has raised several important questions pertaining to transparency, international law, U.S.-Latin American relations, and to the politics of rape. With us now is Latin American specialist Peter Kornbluh. Peter Kornbluh is senior analyst and directs the National Security Archives Cuba and Chile documentation projects. He is also the author of numerous books, including The Cuban Missile Crisis and The Pinochet Files, a declassified dossier on atrocity and accountability. He's also co-author of the Iran-Contra scandal, The Declassified History. Welcome, Peter Kornbluh.
Thank you, Maria. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
I want to start with Ecuador itself and President Rafael Correa, who has publicly stated that WikiLeaks had made the country stronger. How did WikiLeaks make Ecuador stronger? Why this connection, and why is Ecuador now protecting Julian Assange?
I think President Correa is speaking slightly tongue-in-cheek. He was not happy in the beginning with the leaks that came out of the cables. In fact, he threw the U.S. ambassador out for one particular cable that was on the corruption of his appointee to be chief of the national police, creating probably one of the single biggest flaps in Latin America from the WikiLeaks cables. But I think what he's saying is that the ability for the Ecuadorian government to know what the United States was thinking, saying, doing behind the scenes strengthened the government and the people of Ecuador. I mean, in a general thrust of things, WikiLeaks was about the right to know and empowering citizens of Latin America and the rest of the world with information from these secret cables that they would not have otherwise known, or certainly wouldn't have known in a contemporary framework, very close to the time when the documents were written. And so to the degree to which information is power, it was a positive thing for Ecuador and other countries.
So then why would Rafael Correa, the president of Ecuador, be so adamant about protecting Julian Assange now?
President Correa, who's one of the leading populists in Latin America and is kind of emerging from the shadow of Hugo Chavez with this whole episode over WikiLeaks and Julian Assange, kind of on an international stage, shares kind of a common dislike for the United States with Julian Assange, shall we put it that way. And they've bonded over demonizing the United States. And they had one particular episode in which Julian Assange has been a host of a TV show for Russian television before he went into the Ecuadorian embassy. And he invited President Correa to come on his show, and the two of them got along fabulously. Ecuador had extended an invitation for Assange to come from England to Ecuador as his legal situation worsened there last year. And it was the one country where I believe that Julian Assange felt he could basically count on for support if he was going to make the dramatic move that he made on June 19th of this year when he left the estate where he was under house arrest and furtively entered the Ecuadorian embassy to ask for asylum.
Now, in his speech, Julian Assange thanked a whole host of Latin American countries. He thanked Argentina, Bolivia, Nicaragua, Brazil, Chile, Colombia. I mean, he went on and on, Honduras, Mexico, Argentina. What are these countries doing for him, and why would he thank them publicly?
Are you referring to a speech that he gave from the window balcony of the Ecuadorian embassy?
Right, exactly.
This past Sunday, And he is thanking those countries because they, for the most part, not quite all of them, but they sided with Ecuador in the dispute with Great Britain over the sanctity of the embassy itself as a territorial sovereign ground that should not be violated by the British. And we have to distinguish here between three issues that are at play with the whole Julian Assange saga. One is the issue of the charges of rape and sexual misconduct against him in Sweden, and those charges are the grounds for a legitimate request from Sweden to England that Assange be extradited for questioning. He hasn't been charged in this alleged crime, but he is wanted for questioning. That's one issue. The second issue is that the British have threatened to kind of ignore the sovereignty of the embassy and actually suspend Ecuador's diplomatic credentials and come to the embassy and enter it and take Assange out. And there is a British law that was passed some years ago that would allow them to do that. And they had sent a private letter to President Correa reminding him that this law exists and that if they wanted to, they could invoke it. I think they were trying to figure out a way to pressure him to give Assange up. But instead, he rallied all of Latin America to his side on the issue of the sanctity of the embassy itself as a sovereign piece of Ecuador that should not be invaded by the British. And that is what Assange was thanking the other Latin American countries for, their support for Ecuador's position that the British should stay away from the embassy and that to invade the embassy and take Assange would be a territorial violation, an invasion, if you will, of Ecuador itself. And the OAS convened and the foreign ministers are coming together and they've already made a number of statements and they're supporting Ecuador's position on this issue. And the third issue, which is very complicated, is, of course, WikiLeaks itself and what Julian Assange did in leaking, or at least facilitating, the biggest leak of secret U.S. documents in history and disseminating those records electronically to various journalistic outlets around the world, but particularly in Latin America. He is under the threat of prosecution in the United States for violating a law that was passed in 1917 called the Espionage Act. And the allegation is that he aided and abetted the leaker, Bradley Manning, a young soldier who had access to this huge database of documents and who downloaded almost 750,000 documents and sent them off to Julian Assange. And this is what Assange is alleging, that if he gets sent to Sweden, the United States already has orchestrated some plans, a secret plan to have him returned to the United States, prosecuted, and put in jail forever. And he has blurred and obfuscated the whole situation with these allegations of sexual misconduct in Sweden by claiming it's all a frame-up and a setup to get him back to the United States. That is not true. Those are legitimate complaints by two women that he slept with in Sweden that he didn't use a condom, and when he had sex with them, despite their adamant request that he use one, and that he refused to take an AIDS test and evaded them when they pursued him to take an AIDS test, which led them to go to the police and report this complaint. So those are real charges.
And there was another one of non-consensual sex where he actually entered without consent. I mean, that's the one that's the actual rape allegation, is that he entered while she was sleeping.
It's a little bit more complicated than that if you read the police report, which appropriately has been leaked to the press from Sweden about this complaint, which is that they were already together and sleeping, and that in the middle of the night there was kind of a re-engagement of sex, but her position was that she woke up to find him on top of her. She wanted him to use a condom, but he didn't. So those are real issues and a legitimate complaint against him. These women were not set up by the CIA to entrap him, as a few people have suggested. He had sex with both of them. They both found out about each other. They both found out they'd had a common experience with him, kind of pushing sex on them without a condom. And they went to the police to complain when they couldn't get him to answer his phone and answer their messages that they wanted him to take an AIDS test. It is possible that if he had just been a gentleman here and said, yes, of course, you are right, I will go have some blood drawn and tested right now, that he would not be in this legal situation today, because that was their initial complaint against him, that they wanted to be sure that they were safe from disease, having both had unprotected sex with him against their will.
You're an expert on Latin America. You've said that there is kind of a big picture contribution that WikiLeaks has made to Latin America in terms of showing the U.S. role that it has played there for so long and the role that it continues to play, which is somewhat different. If you were first going to encapsulate the big picture, what would you say?
The big picture from these State Department cables is that the United States government is not the behemoth colossus of the North kind of having its way and its will, imperial and imperialist way in the region anymore. The cables are more nuanced than I think people thought they would be about what the U.S. role in the region has been. They show a kind of a routine diplomatic and consular side of the United States. They show the United States trying to spy, you know, in various diplomatic ways on other countries and trying to lobby countries like Colombia, Brazil, to be their allies in a kind of a more aggressive posture against Chavez and Venezuela. They reveal the pro-democracy programs in countries like Venezuela and Cuba, which are certainly objectionable. But in the case of Honduras, for example, where many people thought that this was the latest modern episode of gunboat diplomacy, when in June of 2009, another supporter of Chavez, the President Zelaya, was overthrown by the military and right-wing civilians. The documents actually show that the U.S. ambassador went to the coup plotters after they'd taken power and said, what you've done is illegal. This is a coup. This is not something that was constitutional, and you should retreat. And the cables are clearly kind of chart the evolution thereafter, the U.S. position. And ultimately, the U.S. government acquiesced to this change of government. But we have a sense of what U.S. government's position was early on from these cables that we didn't know before, and that's extremely useful. There's many, many levels and elements to the information in these cables. We're talking about 30,000 cables relating to Latin America, about half of which are kind of just basic, unclassified or limited distribution type of normal reports on the press and on chit-chat with various people, parties and diplomatic functions. But then there are about 900 cables across the region that are classified secret, which are clearly discussions with informants and much more sensitive issues. And there's 10,000 cables that are classified confidential, which also contain sensitive information. So there's a lot to be learned about the U.S. role, but also about the governments themselves and what they were doing, what they were saying to the United States at the time.
If we back up and go into the Nixon administration, the Reagan administration, we see a really dark role of the United States in Latin America, and you've done quite a bit on this yourself, particularly with Chile. But it sounds like the U.S. activities have really changed quite a bit.
I interviewed a journalist in Chile, Francisca Skoknik, who was the journalist who went from Chile to London and picked up from Julian Assange the pen drive that contained all the cables on Chile. And she brought them back to her online newspaper, Speaker Chile, went through them. And as she put it in our interview that's published in The Nation magazine, we were relieved in Chile to find out the United States government was no longer dictating the future of my country. They were no longer the interventionist, imperialist actor that they had been in the 60s and early 70s when they instigated the overthrow of Salvador Allende and helped General Augusto Pinochet consolidate his bloody military dictatorship. And I think that's an interesting observation. It's somewhat different than the journalist who wrote the article in The Nation magazine on Mexico.
Right. Let's talk about Mexico.
She argued that the cable showed that the United States has a very significant role in her government, in planning meetings, in planning policy, in planning strategy, in the war against the narco-terrorists, and that the cables were very revelatory in showing just how close and controlling the U.S. government was to the various actors very high up, all the way up to the level of the president of Mexico over these last 6 years.
In Brazil, we saw a kind of change. Under Brazil, as I understand it, media had been controlled by just a few families, and now publications were starting to discuss this.
You know, the media throughout Latin America is, for the most part, owned by very wealthy families or a handful of conglomerates. And one of the interesting things that we discovered in doing this special issue in The Nation magazine on WikiLeaks in Latin America is the degree to which the newspapers themselves censored information from the cables that they didn't want to publish because the government looked bad and the newspapers were pro-government. Or they made the opposition figures who were caught gossiping or meeting with U.S. officials in the cables, they made the opposition look bad. And, of course, these newspapers were against the government and supporting the opposition. There was just endless amounts of political self-censorship in reporting the full stories of what was said in these cables. And the Brazil example was slightly different because you had an amazing young investigative reporter named Natalia Viana, who now runs an investigative reporting unit called Publica. And she started this investigative group, which is made up only of women, by the way, because there was no independent investigative journalistic outlet in Brazil. And the newspapers there were not fully kind of engaging in the story that she thought was appropriate. And so she first engineered a whole strategy to get as much newspaper coverage as she could out of these kind of papers that were owned by the oligarchy in Brazil. And then when that kind of stopped and dried up, she started her own investigative group and filed another 50 stories. And then the stories moved to bloggers and to new media strategies. And this did have an impact on Brazilian society. And now Brazil is much more involved in investigative reporting and documents, using documents for sources. What her story in The Nation magazine talks about is quite interesting for a country like Brazil, which is now really the leading power in the entire region of Latin America.
Did you see that occurring in any of the other Latin American countries?
You know, the legacy of WikiLeaks will be the degree to which Latin American citizens, citizens around the world, or U.S. citizens, take this information that they were handed and now can access on multiple websites and use it to inform themselves and to push forward the concept of transparency and the right to know. I should point out that these are not the most important documents that the U.S. government generates from countries like Latin America. The CIA documents and the Defense Department documents are going to be much more secret, much more covert, much more revealing if they ever get leaked or declassified. But these cables, which we now have access to, still contain a lot of interesting information that lets you know how, at least diplomatically, the U.S. government works and lets you know a lot about the governments themselves that the United States was dealing with. The media has had an experience in these countries. The citizens who have read these stories have had an experience. Reporters who have dealt with these documents have had a major experience. And hopefully they now, everybody involved, has a higher standard of the desire for information, the desire for transparency, access to government documentation, the effort to learn what your government is doing in your name but without your knowledge. And that will have an impact in the future as debates continue in these countries over Freedom of Information Act laws in Latin America, over whistleblowing in Latin America, over access to documentation on a more routine basis in Latin America. And certainly the way that the United States has handled Julian Assange and the way that the British have now has revived major international attention to the very issue of what he did. I would argue to you that if they would just let the Ecuadorians bring him back to Quito, where he would have been forced to basically live for a long time, he would have been sidelined kind of in some ways from the world community and somewhat marginalized. WikiLeaks was somewhat on its last legs for this recent turn of events. This particular leak of U.S. documents is probably a one-time deal. You and I will be talking again because the leak of Bradley Manning is going to go before a military tribunal and his trial is going to start in late September.
Right, exactly. And that's very important.
And then we'll really be talking about whistleblowing and leaking.
Right.
Julian Assange is in some ways a modern-day cyberpunk messenger. He's not the leaker himself. He's the guy who came up with the global dissemination plan for these documents. But in some ways, he is just a kind of a modern, new age, new media version of a journalist. And WikiLeaks is a journalistic website, obviously, with an agenda. So he is protected and should be protected. The allegations and the possible prosecution that the United States government seems to want to bring against him.
In your article in The Nation, you talked about some changes within certain countries, ambassadors getting fired and disclosing spying and that kind of activity, specifically with regards to Hugo Chavez. How does this play out with regards to Venezuela?
I mean, Venezuela is kind of a bad kid on the block of Latin America besides Cuba, but Venezuela is the real deal. It's a country that has oil, exports oil. It's a wealthy country. Chavez has in past years been able to raise his own level of foreign aid to other countries to outcompete the United States levels of aid. So as a regional actor, Venezuela is an extremely important player, and it's obviously been an actor that wants to push Latin America as a region to the left and to more populist and more kind of contrary and less friendly relations with the United States, push the United States influence out the door and let Latin America be far more independent than it has been in the past. We don't know as much about Venezuela from the documents as we might because the documents didn't really ever get given to a Venezuelan outlet. I guess the argument was that the Venezuelan press was either very opposed to Chavez and therefore kind of a right-wing press that Julian Assange didn't necessarily want to support and empower, or it was completely controlled by the government, and that didn't really bode well for a lot of stories based from U.S. cables. So what they did is Julian Assange gave the Venezuelan documents to the Colombian journalist and said, report these stories. And as Carlos Huerta writes in The Nation magazine, there were a number of stories that they did. They shared their stories with a specific group that has a website in Venezuela, and the stories were simultaneously posted in Venezuela when they were done in La Semana magazine in Bogota. I can't give you a long list of stories, but there were quite a few revelations about what's been going on the border region between Colombia and Venezuela, where FARC, the militant guerrilla group, has had quite a number of hostages. Interestingly enough, the cables revealed that the Colombians, under the previous president, President Uribe, had actually built a base inside Venezuela with the support of the Venezuelan local police military structures in the region. They either bribed them or convinced them to let this base exist inside the Venezuelan border to go after the FARC. Eventually, there were clashes there, and Chavez went ahead and started moving his troops towards the border, and Uribe also started rattling his sabers. And the documents show that the United States officials basically didn't want these two countries to go to war. I mean, you'd think if you were a more sinister suggestion would be the United States would want war between Venezuela and Colombia, and then the United States could come in on the side of Colombia to go after Chavez. But instead, cooler heads prevailed, and the documents showed that the United States was basically trying to kind of reduce these tensions on the border, according to the leaked cables. There are other interesting documents about Venezuela, though. The United States is obviously trying to spy on Chavez. They asked Brazil to officially spy for them because Brazil has close relations with Chavez, and they were told that Brazil does not see Chavez as the same kind of threat that the United States does. And, of course, Brazil is the other leading power besides Venezuela in the whole region. So their opinion really should be taken seriously as expressed in these cables. And there's another set of cables about the democracy programs where the United States is basically trying to figure out a way to finance Chavez's opponents in various regional local elections.
And that seems like a fairly common activity when they don't like a particular leader, isn't it?
It is. It is a common activity. When you look at the amount of money that's actually spent, it's somewhat negligible. And in some ways, it has served Chavez's interest to be able to scream that the United States is trying to meddle in Venezuelan affairs. He's probably gotten more votes out of that than if that dynamic wasn't taking place.
What it seemed like from your article in The Nation magazine was that the effort was really partly trying to isolate Hugo Chavez in terms of Latin American politics.
Absolutely. And, of course, one of the things that the cables show is the degree to which the United States and the Obama administration is concerned about Chavez's ties to Iran and about Iran's efforts through Chavez and other countries to find common ground with Latin America, with Brazil, with Nicaragua, with Ecuador. So you see these cables as you cross kind of regional areas, cross borders. You see cables from a number of different countries about Iran, and those are interesting to put together as well.
Let's talk about how you see this finally unfolding. I understand the British and the Ecuadorian governments have been talking kind of quietly about how to handle it. British government is not recognizing the concept of diplomatic asylum, and yet Latin Americans do recognize this. How do you see this going?
I think that President Correa in Ecuador has very astutely and deftly organized a very strong Latin American reaction to any idea that the British would intrude upon the embassy grounds and take Assange by force or coercion. So I just think that the British would really be risking some of their relations with Latin American countries over something that in the end is not that important. Julian Assange obviously is important for Swedish law and for justice in the case of these two women who have made these accusations against him, that he answer those accusations. But in the grand international scheme of things, this is not the guy you would want to take a stand on and create upheaval in your relations with Latin America about.
And yet it's having this huge effect, it seems, like a standoff between Latin America and Europe, and in many ways, Latin America and the U.S.
Publicly, the United States hasn't been much of a player here. There has been a lot of press reports about a grand jury investigation in Virginia to see if Assange could be prosecuted under the Espionage Act. Certainly, if Mitt Romney is elected president of the United States in November, Assange could have much more to fear of a new Justice Department that comes in that's a lot more conservative than the one we have now, but he seems to have enough to fear from the one we have even right now. So it's not clear whether he's been indicted. It's not clear that he will be indicted. It's not clear if he's indicted that he'd be convicted because he...
You're talking about in Sweden now.
No, I'm talking about here in the United States.
Well, here in the U.S., I mean, the United States...
Under the Espionage Act. So I'm talking about the role of the United States, which is fundamentally unclear.
Right.
Someday, down the line, a successor to WikiLeaks perhaps will get the leaked cable traffic between the United States and Sweden, the United States and Great Britain, so we understand the U.S. role better. Or my organization, the National Security Archive, will obtain these cables through the Freedom of Information Act, and we will know what the United States has been doing behind the scenes on this case. But for now, the U.S. has been trying to kind of stick to the background, and the British are taking the heat. I would suspect that Julian Assange will stay in the embassy for some time longer, and then at some point either he will give up or Ecuador and the British will come to some understanding about him being able to leave and pick up a residency in Quito, which will be somewhat poetic and ironic situation for him. He will become a resident of Latin America, where his work has had a major regional geographic impact, but he will also be further removed from the centers of power and the power of information, and the future of his work from there really does remain unclear.
Well, Peter Kornbluh, thank you so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure. Let's talk again.
Peter Kornbluh is senior analyst and directs the National Security Archive's Cuba and Chile documentation projects, and is the author of numerous books, including The Cuban Missile Crisis and The Pinochet File, a declassified dossier of atrocity and accountability. He's also co-author of The Iran-Contra Scandal, The Declassified History. When we come back, how much will Mitt Romney's financial advantage matter in the presidential race? Stay tuned. Hello and welcome back to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. Just this week, President Obama received some bad news related to the upcoming election. His fundraising is severely trailing Mitt Romney's. In fact, Mitt Romney's financial advantage has more than doubled in July. But in the end, how much does money affect a presidential election? What are the other driving factors? We're joined by three experts. Samuel Popkin is professor of political science at University of California, San Diego. He's the author of numerous books, including The Candidate, What It Takes to Win and Hold the White House, and The Reasoning Voter, Communication and Persuasion in Presidential Campaigns. Jody Baumgartner is professor of political science at East Carolina University and the author of several books, including The American Vice Presidency Reconsidered, co-author of Conventional Wisdom in American Elections, Exploding Myths, Exploring Misconceptions, and Laughing Matters, Humor and American Politics in the Media Age. Alan Lichtman also joins us. He is professor of history at American University and author of many books, including The 13 Keys to the Presidency, The Keys to the White House, and White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement. So welcome to the three of you, Alan Lichtman, Jody Baumgartner, Samuel Popkin. I understand that Mitt Romney has outraised President Obama by a massive amount. Does this really matter in the end? Samuel Popkin, you have been watching campaigns for a very, very long time. How important is the fundraising game?
Well, it's more important, frankly, for the challenger than the incumbent, and it's more important for senators, governors, and congressmen than it is for presidents. Nobody ever wants to have less money, and nobody wants to have the other campaign monopolize all the airtime when they need to reply to a message, but it's not as important now as it would have been earlier in the campaign or in an election where both people were outsiders like 2008.
And why is it less important now?
Because challengers run more on character in the minds of voters, and incumbents run more on what they've done or what they haven't done. So President Obama has a record. He has accomplishments, for good or bad. And Governor Romney is running on promise of the future, so his money will be valuable for him, but not so much for attacking President Obama.
Alan Lichtman, that's a perfect place for you to come in. You actually say that the entire election is a referendum on the incumbent. Does money matter?
Exactly. That is the theory behind my series of books, The Keys to the White House. The Keys to the White House is a system for explaining and predicting presidential elections and being an historian. I developed it in 1981 by going all the way back to 1860, the election of Abraham Lincoln. And from 1984 to 2008, seven elections in a row, it has accounted for, well ahead of time, predicted, sometimes years, the popular vote outcomes of all of those elections. And the theory behind the keys is indeed that the American people are not a herd of sheep driven hither and yon by the ad men, the hucksters, the pollsters, and the consultants, but they're very pragmatic. And they look to see whether, not just based on the economy, but a lot of factors, whether the incumbent administration, the administration holding the White House, deserves another 4 years. And I look at the economy, foreign policy, successes and failures, scandal, social unrest, policy change, the emergence of third parties. And right now, and for some time, I first issued a prediction in January 2010, Obama looks good enough for re-election, regardless of how much money Romney raises or regardless of anything that Mitt Romney can do on the campaign trail. I agree with Sam Popkin. Every other kind of election counts for a lot, but it doesn't count for much in presidential elections. Franklin Roosevelt won 46 or 48 states and 60% of the vote. He was roundly outspent by Alf Landon. But in presidential elections, we know who the candidates are. You don't have to promote name recognition. They all have enough money to get their message out. We see them in the conventions. We see them in the debates. So my view is take the $1.5 billion that each campaign might spend this time and give it to charity. It'd be much better spent.
If I can add a word on Professor Lichtman's very clear statement, with which I agree, for years liberals worried that Fox would devour the nation or that the Citizens United would destroy democracy. and I certainly abhor the Citizens United decision, but if the PAC money has made a difference so far, it was in the Republican primary funding a fortune in attacks on the nominee, Governor Romney, financed by super PACs backed in one for Governor Perry of Texas and for Newt Gingrich.
Jody Baumgartner.
I'm not going to disagree with either of the gentlemen said. I just was thinking about two other sort of minor points that speak to this question from an ancillary perspective. Number one of the things that a lot of people don't understand is that money does not buy an election. And thank goodness for that. In a representative democracy, it's supposed to be the case that money shouldn't matter. We shouldn't be able to buy votes. Now, money certainly matters in the sense that if you don't have any, or if you run out when, say, for example, as Professor Popkin said, your opponent's attacking you, it might make a bit of a difference. I mean, without money, you certainly can't do anything. You can't organize, you can't mobilize, you can't really do anything. But just because you have more money than your opponent doesn't necessarily guarantee a win. The second reason why I'm not sure it much matters in this particular cycle, at this particular stage, is that, you know, at this stage of the campaign, most people have made up their minds already, and that's not necessarily something that I think most people understand. Better than 9 out of 10 people who are going to vote already know who they're going to vote for or are already pretty sure of who they're going to vote for. Yeah, that undecided 5 or 10% is definitely going to matter, but going back to what Professor Popkin said, how much is this barrage of ads going to really affect what those people think? I'm not so sure that it much matters.
Well, let's talk about that 5 or 10% because most of the talk when we hear the pundits on the air is there's a focus on the battleground states and not even the battleground states, but particular counties within battleground states. And they consider these people to be the undecideds or the swing voters. Who really matters and who really makes the final decision in these elections? Jody Baumgartner, you started, so why don't you continue and then let's pass it back.
It's certainly the case, just to sort of expand on your setup or your premise, that campaigns in the past several decades, and certainly increasingly so, have gotten much more scientific in who they're targeting and where they're targeting them. It's well understood that, you know, there's not going to be a lot of ad money spent in Texas because we know who's going to win in Texas. Similarly in California, we know that Romney really doesn't have a chance there. So the Romney campaign isn't going to spend a lot of money there. They're not going to do a lot of campaigning there. They're going to focus on the states where those swing states that you were referring to. Now, within those states, I mean, who these people are is an open question. Who is a swing voter? What is a swing voter? Is a question that political science really doesn't have a good answer for. Sometimes it might be a person who varies from election to election. It might be a person who's just sort of undecided at this moment. But what campaigns are able to do and increasingly are doing is drawing on a wealth of data about purchasing habits and lifestyle choices and things like that to target, say, these counties of people or these areas within these swing states to try and persuade these people. The persuadables is what they're called in some circles.
Well, Joey, you bring up the issue, but in several campaigns, I was in charge of allocating all that money, and it's very much, as you say, something of the fog of war because it's based on what people did in the last election and your hope of whether they'll do it again. And it's very hard to judge honestly the effect of much of the work. Only in the last 10 years have people even gotten honest reports, really, from a quality of research that matters, because everybody wants to claim they won the election. And so there's as much puffery about what worked in a campaign as there is in the fights after a war, of whether it was the Army, the Navy, or the Air Force that won the war. And if you look at what states are considered battlegrounds, though, you will see that nobody honestly thinks that all the money in the world can move an electorate more than a percent or two. Nobody is looking at any state to spend substantial money that doesn't look within a few points or is one of the 10 most competitive. Nobody is saying we can do so well with our magic media or our $1.5 billion or with Karl Rove's mojo that we could move a state 10 points or 8 points or even really 5 points.
Sam Popkin, you're the one who studies the campaign strategies and the campaign communication, symbolic politics. In your latest book, you talk about the three most important aspects of these campaigns. And since we're targeting so few voters in so few locations, what matters?
Well, you have to give people a vision of the future that's credible and that's preferable to your opponent's vision. And that's where the discussion of Professor Lichtman is so relevant. If you want the campaign only to be about the economy, you have to neutralize all the other issues on the way. The economy, comma, stupid, to be the subject in 1992, Bill Clinton had to remove crime, welfare, and a number of other issues from the distinctions between the candidates and parties. That is surprisingly something a great corporate strategist, Mitt Romney, who has run for president before, has failed to do. I am continually surprised by the strategic lapses of a sophisticated corporate CEO.
Alan Lichtman.
Jump in here. This is Alan Lichtman. Let me start with a little bit of ranting, if I may, but I won't be too loud about it. You know, you're talking about campaigning in 10 states, and that is an absolute crying shame. It is an artifact of a long outmoded electoral college system, you know, that was adopted in the 1780s in a very different time, in part to preserve the power of slave states in the South. And slaves did not vote, but they were counted 3/5 in the Electoral College, in part to preserve the power of very small states because they were guaranteed 3 Electoral College votes. It is almost tantamount to a crime that we're not campaigning in Texas and New York and California. Not that I think campaigns are all that edifying. In addition, you don't win elections by pinpointing particular voters. That's not what differentiates the two campaigns or candidates. In my view, elections swing across the board one way or another based on the factors that I outlined in my 13 keys. Obviously, not every group is going to swing exactly the same way, but pretty much the dominoes do fall in one direction or the other in each and every election. And I do think that is an extremely important thing to realize, even in these days when we have all of this micro research and all of this micro focus on voters. Finally, I agree very much with what Sam Pupkin pointed out. We say it's the economy, but there are a host of other issues. For example, the conventional pundits say, well, foreign policy and defense policy is of no importance because the Romney campaign isn't attacking Obama on that. It is of immense importance that the Romney campaign is not attacking Obama on foreign policy and defense. For decades, Republicans had slammed Democrats for being soft in foreign and defense policy, too soft on communism, too soft on terrorism. It is of the utmost significance that Obama has taken that out entirely. Republicans aren't even making that argument. So the pundits making a huge mistake by concluding that because something is not pounded on by the challengers, it doesn't matter in this election.
This is Sam Pupkin. The definition of newsworthy from the point of view of a daily journalist is very different from what matters to people, and maybe an issue has been decided in their minds. I mean, I would like to point out that Osama bin Laden, one way or the other, is no longer a threat to the United States. And that's a very effective answer to a lot of attacks on wussy, wimpy foreign policy in the eyes of many voters.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar's Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the key determinants of presidential elections. Well, there are two other factors I'd like to pull in and get your thoughts on. One is the issue of voter turnout and how important that is. We hear a lot of talk right now on the Republican side claiming voter fraud, on the Democrat side saying that's just a tactic to try to disenfranchise minorities especially. And then the other factor, and we could take these one by one, is the vice president factor. Jody Baumgartner, you've written about the vice presidential effect, and Alan Lichtman, you've spoken about this particular one. So Jody Baumgartner, you've been quiet for a bit. Why don't you talk to us about these factors and how you see it playing in?
I can speak to the vice presidency aspect of it with the vice presidential candidacy aspect of it with some confidence. The fact of the matter is that vice presidential candidates really don't matter. At the end of the day, now, there isn't a lot of research on this, but virtually all of it suggests that vice presidential candidates really don't matter, except maybe at the margins, but not in any type of a way that's ever decided an election. Regardless of whether John McCain had selected Sarah Palin or some other prominent Republican who would not have sort of looked like Palin in the election, McCain was never going to win, right? That wasn't Sarah Palin's fault. Did it affect the perception of the ticket or his decision-making or his leadership ability? Sure it did. So I don't know that you're going to get any great benefit from it. I don't know that it's going to do you that much harm either at the end of the day. I think that the selection of Ryan did one positive thing, absolutely. It sort of gave Mitt Romney an ability to say to a conservative Republican base, I really am one of you. Now, whether that really works or not, we'll see. It's also a kind of a risky strategy, right? Because Paul Ryan has been kind of a lightning rod for Democrats and for even some moderates with respect to his position on the budget. So it remains an open question to see how that's going to play out.
This is Sam Popkin. I have to disagree somewhat with Professor Baumgartner on the choice of Ryan. It was the choice of Paul Ryan was about more than playing to the conservative base, which was already 98% fired up and ready to go to stop the heretic in the White House. But the Ryan budget was already the focus of 435 Democrats running for Congress, and better to have Ryan on the ticket so that whatever changes were made in the Ryan budget perceptually would be defended by somebody who wanted to get to be vice president. When candidates in the past have looked at vice presidents, they've normally said, will it help me with an issue? Will it help me with a trait? Or will it help me to look better when voters see me? That was what happened with Al Gore, for example, and that is what happened with George W. Bush and Dick Cheney. But in the end, as Nate Silver has so well pointed out, and Professor Baumgartner commented, it's a small effect. What it does do is change the issues the other side campaigns on. A whole host of ads about pollution in Arkansas were never aired by the Republicans once you had Al Gore on the ticket with Bill Clinton. And a whole host of attacks on George W. Bush, and weakness on foreign policy and defense were never aired again once you had Richard Cheney on the ticket. So whether that matters is something more Professor Lichtman has dealt with.
Professor Lichtman, why don't you jump in, and then Jody Baumgartner, if you'd like to respond.
I just want to jump in very briefly on this. I have 13 keys. That's a lot of keys. I don't have a vice presidential key. It doesn't matter. Both professors gave lots of examples of, you know, vice presidents having contrarian effects. I would cite another one, Dan Quayle. People said, tore their hair when George H.W. Bush picked Dan Quayle in 1988. Dan Quayle had the worst debate performance until Admiral Stockton in the history of debating. And yet H.W. came from behind in the polls. I always had him winning and won an easy victory. I would like to talk, and I don't want to lose this issue, about voter ID and voter suppression, because I think that is a critically important issue. I can get into it now or let Professor Baumgartner respond on the vice president.
Yeah, let's just finish this thought, then we'll go to that, because I think it's very important as well. And just one prompt, Professor Baumgartner, and that is the idea of the state that the vice president represents, Wisconsin in this case, being an important state. But also, isn't there a religion factor with Ryan being a Catholic? Isn't that a constituency that's important? What do you think of that?
You know, I'm a little different than the universe of people who sort of talk about the veep stakes. I actually have a statistical model. Professor Lichtman has his 13 keys. I have a statistical model predicting the vice presidential selection, and my model actually predicted Paul Ryan as Romney's selection. I don't disagree with what Professor Popkin said with respect to the issue orientation of the selection and the campaign, and I don't think that necessarily detracts from what I said about helping establish his conservative credentials. The fact of the matter is we can plug a lot of these things into models, and there's still going to be some intangibles that cannot be quantified and defined. There's a lot of things that go into these selections. One of the things in my model, for example, is how competitive the vice presidential candidate's home state was in the previous election. And Wisconsin, it turns out, is a bit more competitive than some of the other contenders for the slot. I don't know about the religion factor. The only thing I really looked at was the fact that, unlike most presidential candidates, Romney is not a mainstream Protestant, and therefore that sort of threw any type of religious balancing of the ticket into sort of a flux that I couldn't really figure out and still haven't figured out.
Alan Lichtman, I heard you kind of in the background. I couldn't hear what you were saying, but let's go back now to this issue of how important voter turnout is and how important these attempted laws are of making voting more difficult and the effect they might have on the election. I mean, we saw Florida in 2000.
Florida in 2000 proved a few hundred votes could decide an election. George Bush won that by 537 votes. So while these voter ID laws, I don't think, are going to move the needles on the national popular vote, if the Electoral College is close, and if there is a very tight election in an individual state, say Pennsylvania or Virginia, voter ID laws could make the difference, because every study shows that those least likely to have IDs tend to be minorities who are overwhelmingly Democratic. There's no dispute that if voter IDs have any partisan effect, it favors Republicans. In fact, after the Pennsylvania photo ID law was passed, the majority leader, the House, the Republican majority leader, said, all right, we got this law passed. This is going to enable Romney to win Pennsylvania. Check. That was a rare, unguarded moment. But I think it does expose what's really behind these voter ID laws. There is no threat to our democracy from impersonation at the polls, which these laws are designed to prevent. In Pennsylvania, when the case went to the court, the state admitted they could not cite a single case of voter impersonation.
Texas, I'd like to second what Professor Lichtman said. Voter suppression, unfortunately, is American as apple pie. And there's a long history. Notice in none of the states that passed the laws did they think, instead of passing a law that said life in prison or 10 years in jail for voting if you weren't the citizen, instead they said no voting if you don't have an ID. And there's no doubt what the intent was. And what's going to happen now is thousands and thousands of lawyers descending on all of these states. And it's going to be a very, very bitter election day in some of these states. And I suspect part of the intent of the laws is to prematurely intimidate people to think they don't want to be part of a mess if they go to the polls.
One other factor I'd like to bring in now, and Jody Baumgartner, this is also something you've studied, because this issue has been highlighted on both the Jon Stewart Show and the Stephen Colbert Report. In fact, that clip that Professor Lichtman is talking about was shown on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart making satire out of it. What is the impact of Comedy Central and political satire on things like this?
We have found that political humor moves opinion in sort of a message consistent effect for those who view it. Now, we should note, for those who view it, is typically a smaller universe than we like to believe. For all of the press and the attention that gets paid to Comedy Central, it's important to remember it's a niche cable audience. And while what Stewart does and says, or what Colbert does and says, gets amplified through a 24/7 media environment, the fact of the matter is there's a few million people that watch every night. That's not a lot of people. That's just not a lot of people. And beyond that, the people who typically watch, particularly Comedy Central, are already the people who are a little more politically knowledgeable, a little more politically interested, and therefore are less easily swayed. Point. The people who are watching Comedy Central are less likely to be really greatly influenced by the satire. Now, there are people who just sort of casually turn in, and those people could be, but I'm not so sure it matters that much. And believe me, I spent a lot of time researching this stuff. I'd like for it to matter more than it does, but I'm not sure it does.
I guess we should close with a couple of questions. Now, Alan Lichtman, I got your message in terms of your prediction. You still see it as Obama's election to win?
Absolutely. The big picture strongly favors Obama. Even if you just looked at the economy alone, you wouldn't necessarily come to that conclusion. But when you look at the everything put together, my prediction from more 2.5 years ago still stands, Obama in 2012.
Now, some political scientists think that people generally are one-issue voters, the economy, abortion, these kinds of issues, kind of simplistic. And a couple of professors in Colorado ran a statistical model that they say has been right since 1980, has not failed.
That is a canard and a falsehood, and I'm really ashamed either of the media or those two professors. One of those professors is 40 years old. How in the world was he predicting elections in 1980? That model has not predicted results since 1980. It has been applied retrospectively to 1980 to account for results that are already known. Yet all over the media is, oh, this model has predicted every election since 1980. Absolutely false.
It shows that even academics are willing to go to great lengths to make headlines in this multimedia world. And anybody who thinks the model is realistic should look at Nate Silver's 538.com blog, where he takes it apart piece by piece and shows how badly done the model is.
Thank you, gentlemen, so much. Alan Lichtman, professor of history at American University and the author of books including The 13 Keys to the Presidency, The Keys to the White House and the White, Protestant Nation, The Rise of American Conservative Movement. Jody Baumgartner, professor of political science at East Carolina University, author of books including The American Vice Presidency Reconsidered, co-author of Conventional Wisdom in American Elections, Exploding Myths, Exploring Misconceptions and Laughing Matters, Humor in American Politics and the Media Age. Samuel Popkin, professor of political science at UC San Diego, the author of numerous books, including the one just coming out, The Candidate, What It Takes to Win and Hold the White House, and The Reasoning Voter, Communication and Persuasion in Presidential Campaigns, co-author of Issues and Strategies, The Computer Simulation of Presidential Campaigns. And I should just add, Samuel Popkin, you've been a consulting analyst in presidential campaigns for a very long time. Thank you all so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to Ankina Aghasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Ishmael Karim. If you missed a part of the show, you can always go back to kpfk.org, go to the audio archives. You can always podcast us and follow us at scholarcircle.org, armudian.com, and on Twitter at armudian. See you next week. May your goal.